Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 59 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Our mission is to come to your earbuds every 2 weeks with discussions of some of the latest research that is especially relevant in the world of clinical dermatology, so that you can feel like you are up to date on the current happenings in dermatology and don't have to spend as much time flipping through articles or scrolling through emails in order to be at the top of your game. And today we've got a nice collection of articles, and the first one is an especially fun one, and it is about dermatology memes. So we have discussed a couple articles in the past by these authors who have become some of my favorite authors, Georgia Kirikou and Apostolos Glentis out of Greece. So for example, in episode 37, we discussed an article they had written about the depiction of baldness among movie villains and how alopecia seems to be associated with a portrayal of villainy or evilness. And in episode 56, we discussed a very fun article about dermatoses associated with playing video games. So they published a lot of fun stuff that is related to the intersection of art and dermatology and popular culture. And this article is no different. So it's published in our publication called Skin Med, and it's called Meme This, the Mimetic Replication of Dermatologist Stereotype Through the World Wide Web. It's not exactly a study, it's more of an opinion essay. So a meme, M-E-M-E, is supposedly the cultural equivalent of a gene. I have been interested in memes sort of in an academic sense before they became this internet phenomenon. The term was coined by Richard Dawkins way back in the 70s. So a meme is supposed to be a unit of culture rather than of genetic material, but like genes, memes can replicate, spread, mutate, and evolve, or not, and survival of the fittest plays a role. So a unit of culture. What is a unit of culture? Well, it can be just about anything. It can be like a quote from a movie, it can be a television commercial, it can be some kind of religious or secular ritual. But you can see how these sorts of things can change, evolve, spread, or those that don't sort of catch our interest as humanity can just kind of die away, like a species that didn't quite live up to its niche. That's all sort of the academic definition of a meme. But in the modern world, a meme often refers to some kind of internet-based content, especially to like a single image with one caption that's supposed to be humorous and often can ridicule human behavior. So one of my favorite early examples of a meme is the Oh Really Owl. If you remember that character from the early days of the internet, there was like this goofy looking snowy owl with big eyes and opening its mouth. And he looked like he was saying like, what? And the caption was always like, oh, really? So if somebody said something that surprised you or you wanted to ironically pretend to be surprised, you could post the Oh Really Owl and everybody would think that you were a grandmaster of internet humor. And then this medium itself has evolved. So the authors here point out that in addition to offering a reflection of public opinion, there are at least some academics that posit that memes also can play a crucial role in molding perceptions about groups. And the portrayal of physicians through memes has the potential to influence public perception, and many groups are stereotyped in memes, and dermatologists are no exception. So the authors of this article kind of scrolled through a bunch of forums and internet sites where you can find memes, places like Reddit and Cheeseburger and other sites that I assume people younger than me tend to look at. And that makes me assume that the authors are also younger than me, but that's all right. And they found that there are a lot of negative portrayals in dermatologists in memes. So some of the persistent negative stereotypes are that dermatologists are glorified beauticians, that we have a small degree of responsibility since we don't treat a lot of life-threatening conditions, that being a dermatologist is easy. So there are a couple of quotes they found, such as, Botox, Accutane, 3 o'clock tea time, which is totally wrong because I don't play golf. And also something we've been hearing since medical school, if it's wet, dry it. If it's dry, wet it. Which I never really understood, because, I mean, I admit that if somebody has dry skin, I do encourage them to moisturize it. But if it's wet, dry it, I like, how often do you do drying stuff? Like intertrigo, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Another stereotype is that we are profit-driven with a lax work schedule. So this one I hadn't heard of, Derma Holiday instead of dermatology. Ah. Kind of fun. They have some pictures of memes that they include in their article. So there's this picture of a bunch of old white dudes laughing uproariously at a cocktail party. Looks like they might be senators or something. They are a bunch of old white dudes after all. So what are they laughing at? Well, the caption says, "And then I told them I was fascinated by the pathology of skin lesions." Ha 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 ha. The idea being, would anybody ever believe that that's why you wanted to go into dermatology? It's obviously the Botox Accutane tea time issue. That another negative stereotype is that dermatologists treat everything with cortisol or topical steroids. So there's another one that they have published in here in the article. It says, when something happens to the skin, and it shows a hand racing toward a big blue button, and the hand says dermatologists and the blue button says cortisol. Like, that's all we do. We do use a lot of topical steroids, but you know, you can see the negative stereotype here. There are some other stereotypes that seem to be perpetuated that aren't quite so negative, and some might even be positive. So we use a lot of elaborate medical terminology. That's true. So we have great MAs here at the University of Utah, and they often will scribe for us when we're in the room, and I usually will sort of describe the physical exam while I'm examining the patient. So I'll say, you know, scattered erythematous papules and pustules on the face with few open and closed comedones or something, and the patient will, like, give me this weird look, and I'll say, we just make up words to sound smarter than we are. So it looks like some of the memes might be catching on to that. And another stereotype is that we are physically attractive, well-dressed, and chill-tempered. That's true of me anyway.
Yeah, can you argue with the, you know, physically attractive part of that? I actually remember when I was in my intern year having sort of an uncomfortable moment with a internal medicine faculty member when they asked me what specialty I was going into, because they knew I was a prelim, and I said, oh, dermatology. He's like, oh, I should have known you were going into derm. Derm has this history of having, and he like tried to find a word. He's like, pretty girls, like, and he got flustered. It was very uncomfortable and weird.
Pretty girls was what he came up with.
Yeah. You know, it was probably better than what was initially in there, given the amount of time that there was some hemming and hawing.
All right. Well, we're all pretty in dermatology. That part's true. So the authors point out that while all of this is in good fun to some degree, there are some actual studies that show that these sorts of misperceptions about dermatologists, you know, we're glorified beauticians, we're kind of not real doctors, are also common among the lay public. And so this is one reason why I like what these authors do. It's sort of like this baldness and movie villain study, because they make me think about society. Does art mimic life or influence life? You know, probably both. So if the lay public thinks that we are glorified beauticians or that we treat everything with steroids, then of course these memes, which I suppose are a form of art, just mimic what the current perceptions are out there. Conversely, to what degree does this art influence people's public perception about what we do? It's kind of an interesting question, and I'm sure that there's a fair amount of both at work here. So this was not, you know, a rigorous study, and I'm not sure that the picture is quite as bleak as the authors paint here. All respect to you guys, Georgia and Apostolos. So I Googled dermatology meme and also dermatologist meme, and I found memes that were mostly funny, but not disparaging, at least in the first batch of results. So, for example, I've posted a few of them. Oh, I didn't post them. I copied them here. There's a picture here of looks like an actor, possibly Nicolas Cage, with a big, like, shiny Mardi Gras mask on his face. I assume that's from some movie. And the caption is, "The dermatologist said if I use the cream, this will go away in about a week to 10 days." That's kind of funny. It's not disparaging. There's another picture here. It's a black and white picture of a pretty girl, I guess you would say. And the caption is, "Pale? I'm not pale. It's called porcelain, and I'm rocking it." That's fine. And there's a picture of three dudes in a swimming pool. Two of them are quite tan and one of them is pasty, pasty white. And the caption is, "Can you spot the dermatologist?" I mean, that's kind of funny and not disparaging. I mean, that kind of thing is certainly true when my family like goes somewhere sunny, like an amusement park. Like we're all in these long sleeve sun shirts and the kids are all wearing big hats and everybody else is wearing their wife beaters. It's pretty obvious who the dermatology family is. And then this other one I found, there's an angry looking person and it says, "Dermatologist, good morning." And every other doctor, "Shut up about the sun, shut up about the sun." So, you know, I think all that stuff's kind of fun. I think it might be interesting to do some kind of objective study where you actually find the most prevalent or popular or most searched for memes for dermatologists or like for any group, perhaps, to try to get a pulse on society's current opinion of that group.
I think it's super funny. One of my favorite memes that I've sent around recently is sustainable skincare advice from my dermatologist. Number one, avoid the sun at all costs. Number two, use sunscreen before going to bed at night. Number three, never think about the sun. Number four, wear a wide-brimmed hat in the shower. And number five, if someone mentions the sun to you, report them to the authorities. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Excellent. So again, I don't know how much this influences my clinical practice, but it's something that makes me think. And like the baldness in movie villains, again, I found myself thinking about this article, you know, more than I do about other articles after I've done reading them and the intersection of society and dermatology and all that fun stuff.
I like it. Well, speaking of the intersection of dermatology and society, I will bring to you now an article and a product, which I have decided to approach from two different angles. So we have this very nice, well-written article that goes through the basic science of how this new treatment, collagenase clostridium histiolyticum, AAES, for the treatment of cellulite in women, the results from two phase three randomized placebo controlled trials. So we have this lovely article that goes over how that treatment works. And then just to see how this is marketed to the lay people, I looked into this as a, you know, pretend lay person and found the website where I could get more information about the product. So the product is going through the branding, I think, of the name Quo, Q-W-O. But if you are a lay person and you are interested in this product, you get invited to join sort of an email list that is called the House of Booty, which I thought was kind of cute and catchy.
The House of Booty.
The House of Booty, yes, B-O-O-T-Y.
Because it's marketed toward pirates.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Because it's, you know, very much going for the pirate community. So this is marketed to treat cellulite on the buttocks. So the House of Booty, and I think they're having a play on words like House of Beauty, House of Booty. It's cute. So we shall discuss.
So is this a boutique product?
Aha. Ba-da-dum-bum-bum. Okay. So we're going to discuss this article. This is a nice article published in Dermatologic Surgery, and it has 17 authors. I kind of looked into all of the authors and found three of the 17 authors are women. All of the rest of them are men. No disparagement there, just interesting phenomenon-wise. But the article wants to describe how this product has come to the market and what its potential use is going to be in the sort of general cosmetic marketplace. So as a background, we believe that fibrous septae play a role in contour alterations associated with cellulite, specifically in women. And they wanted to assess collagenase clostridium histiolyticum AAES, which we will from now on go forward calling CCH, for the treatment of cellulite. To do this, two identically designed phase three double-blind randomized studies were done, release one and release two. In both of these studies, adult women with moderate to severe cellulite were enrolled. Now, to define what moderate to severe cellulite is, they used something called the patient-reported photonumeric cellulite severity scale, PR-PCCS, and the clinician-reported photonumeric cellulite severity scale, which is the PCSS on the buttocks. And so they are actually basing this off of an article previously published that kind of enumerates these different stages of severity of cellulite. And basically it goes in a graded scale from 0 to 4, where 0 is no cellulite at all. 1 is almost none, just a few superficial dimples. 3 is superficial dimples with some ridges. Most of them are superficial. 3 is moderate. So many dimples and ridges, most of which somewhat deep, and severe is a lot of dimples and ridges, which are deep, covering most of the skin area. So 4 would be the most severe. So they enrolled patients in the moderate to severe category of this patient and clinician reported photonumeric cellulite severity scale. They then treated these patients with 3 treatment sessions of subcutaneous CCH, 0.84 milligrams or placebo per treatment area. And they looked for a composite response of improvement of greater than 2 levels, greater than or equal to 2 levels, or greater than or equal to 1 level improvement. So they set 2 potential goals, one very stringent one, where they would improve, say, from severe to mild or from moderate to almost, which is a very ambitious goal. The second one they set was improving by greater than or equal to 1 level. So going from severe to moderate or moderate to mild, which is much achievable, obviously. And then they, of course, measured the patient's and the clinician's assessment of their response up to day 71 of the treatment. So they enrolled.
You said they measured their assessment?
I did say it that way, and I didn't mean to. And then I was like, he's going to hear it, and he's going to say it.
But, nothing gets past me.
You know, I mean,
I'm always one for a wisecrack.
Maybe we could, honestly, as a shorthand, we're just going to call that the assessment, you know, going forward. Because I don't want to say the PRPCSS and the CRPCSS. It's a tongue twister. So we're just going to call it the assessment. All right. So they had these 843 women that received greater than or equal to 1 injection of CCH. They did some relatively rigorous analysis here. So they actually used both the non-responder interpolation as well as an intention to treat analysis. So what that means, and this is a little pimpable, is that patients who were enrolled in the treatment arm were measured and their data was gathered as if they had been treated, even if they withdrew from the study or were lost to follow-up. And then the NRTI, the non-responder interpolation, is where they basically lose somebody to follow-up. They interpret that as a lack of response. So both of these, they made this stringent for themselves. So they had a high level of ambitiousness setting their primary goal, and they also were very rigorous in the assessment of their data. So with these 843 women, they had divided them into placebo and in treatment arms. They found greater percentages of the CCH-treated women with greater than 2 level composite responders versus placebo. So 7.6%, again, that was a very, very ambitious aim. So 7.6% of patients in the treatment arm in release 1 and 5.6% of patients in release 2 in the treatment arm achieved that greater than or equal to 2 level composite improvement. So, you know, again, that is not a lot of those patients getting that really impressive improvement, but some patients did. They did much better with the greater than 1 level, greater than or equal to 1 level composite improvement. So 37% in release 1 and 41% in release 2 getting at least 1 grade of improvement versus placebo, which was 17% in release 1 and 11% in release 2. Both of them reached this statistical significance. Most of their adverse events occurred in the treatment group, predictably. These were injection site related. However, few women discontinued treatment because of an adverse effect. So less than 4% of patients kind of dropped out of the trial because of an adverse event. So it was well tolerated and it improved the appearance of cellulite. So they go on to talk about the fact that cellulite is an alteration of skin topography. Now, a lot of time when we define a disease, this is going to be something that affects a minority of people. With the exception of if you think about aging as a disease, which affects everybody, if you think about most diseases, you would say less than half of most people would be affected by it. Cellulite affects 80 to 98% of postpubertal women. So I would actually argue that it is normal. However, it has been somewhat pathologized in our society, and our current beauty standards define it as undesirable.
And our booty standards.
And our booty standards as well. The house of booty, you know, they define this as sort of undesirable. So this is a dimpled appearance of affected skin. The high prevalence in women is associated, they postulate, with sex-specific differences in the anatomy of the skin and subcutaneous tissue, which may be driven by estrogen. And that can include less regular dermal subcutaneous interface or a different configuration of subcutaneous tissue and fat cell changes, which can allow for fat cell herniation, as well as differences in lobulation amount and distribution of fat. And
so women get a lot more cellulite. I don't think I knew that.
Women are more predisposed to have the presentation of cellulite and are more judged by and bothered by it. So it is something that I think there's a societal pressure to minimize for women. They say there are also differences in number, type, orientation, and interrelated to the fibrous septae. And they point out that women with cellulite can experience emotional distress, negative feelings that can detrimentally affect their self-esteem and quality of life. So they wanted to look for ways to treat this. The fibrous septae play an important role in contour alterations associated with cellulite, and successful clinical outcomes have targeted the fibrous septae. So that kind of supports the idea that the pathophysiology of cellulite can be attributed to the sort of structural and biomechanical properties of the subdermal junction. And there's an imbalance between containment and extrusion forces. So it's just an unmet need for safe, effective, microinvasive, stable therapies. And an injectable would be somewhat ideal for this. And so they've started to look into this collagenase Clostridium histiolyticum AAES, which is composed of two purified bacterial collagenases. So this is AUX1 and AUX2, clostridial class 1 and 2 collagenases, and these hydrolyze type 1 and type 3 collagen with high specificity under physiologic conditions that can allow for the disruption of targeted collagen structures.
It's probably worth pointing out that, to my knowledge, nothing has been shown to help cellulite. I have a talk that I give about pregnancy and dermatology, and cellulite's one of the things we go over, and there have been some studies into it. But as far as I can tell, nothing works. Perhaps until now, though, as you point out, it's not like dramatic, but it's still better than the nothing we had.
And there is a huge market for the reduction of cellulite. If you spend any time on any social media platforms, especially if you are a woman who has interacted with the site and has not turned all of that information sharing stuff off, you'll be targeted a lot with ads for suction cup devices, you know, things that look like a bread machine that you can kind of use to knead your skin with, something called a fascia blaster, which some studies may indicate have potentially got some benefit to kind of deep tissue massage and possibly enhanced lymphatic drainage. At one point, there was a device that actually would be sort of used to on a minute scale, sever some of those subcutaneous tethers underneath the surface of the skin, but that led to some skin drooping changes that were not desirable. So that product didn't live on the market for very long. But this
what
is
about
a
cryolipolysis.
Cryolipolysis, you know, cryolipolysis more decreases the number and density of fat cells than it alters the structure of the fibrous septae. So there's some patients can improve the appearance of cellulite with cryolipolysis, but I think it's more due to reduction of adipose tissue than it is to remodeling of the fibrous septae. So this is something that is a different way to think about it. This product was approved in the United States in July of 2020 for the treatment of moderate to severe cellulite on the buttocks of adult women. It is somewhat analogous to a different formulation of collagenase Clostridium histiolyticum called Xiaflex, also produced by Endo Pharmaceuticals, which is the company that makes this product, Quo.
And sponsored this study.
Yeah. Xiaflex is used for the treatment of collagen-associated disorders such as Dupuytren's contracture with a palpable cord, or Peyronie's disease, which affects gentlemen with a palpable plaque and penile curvature deformity of greater than 30% at treatment initiation. So that's another collagenase product that's used to disrupt a fibrous structure. And so the mechanism of action of CCH for cellulite-related contour alterations is enzymatic disruption of the fibrous septae that helps improve skin smoothing. And so they did this nice phase 2 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study with relatively rigorous statistical analysis, and they did find that patients did statistically significantly improve, the medication was well tolerated, and that the adverse events were mild, and most patients did not withdraw from treatment. So I thought that that was a well-done study. I thought it was very rigorously performed. I think they did a good job of demonstrating that it can cause improvement as well as demonstrating that it is safe. They did find, interestingly enough, that patients did form blocking antibodies to the injected product, which is not a huge response, huge surprise, since it's a bacterially produced enzyme. That did not seem to have any effect on the efficacy of the product. But interestingly, patients suffered the most adverse effects in terms of both bruising and discomfort after the first treatment session. And those adverse events decreased with each subsequent treatment session. So I wonder if the blocking antibodies actually didn't serve some kind of partially protective role in decreasing the adverse events in subsequent treatment. I also do wonder if that means that you would have diminishing returns as you went along in treating these patients, because that is, you know, blocking antibodies with injectables is sort of a nebulous concept that we don't 100% understand how it interacts with the efficacy of the product. But I think that is something that could be interesting to investigate with further studies. So, you know, they did also enumerate the way that the injection process was done. And they also emphasized the fact that since they were going for a standardized injection technique, that may have decreased the efficacy of the treatment for some patients, as, you know, some patients might have been better treated utilizing a different injection protocol. So the way that they did the injection was kind of standardized through videos used to train the study investigators, and they would administer 3 0.1 milliliter aliquots, 1 aliquot administered perpendicular to the skin, and 2 aliquots administered at a 45 degree angle, superior or inferior to the perpendicular axis of the dimple. And so that's another potential way that as they get this product into the hands of the, you know, dermatologists and plastic surgeons who will probably be predominantly using this, that they might be able to develop nuanced techniques to more specifically address the needs of individual patients. But I am glad that this is something that exists. I also see the possibility for utility for this product in tethered scars. You know, this could be something that could be useful in many other applications. Collagenase is collagenase, and it works where you put it. You know, that's why we have the product Xiaflex that's used for treatment of Dupuytren's contracture and Peyronie's disease. Now, it's important to think about the functional aspects of the collagenase membranes where you might use this product. So, for example, this Xiaflex is used to treat Dupuytren's and to treat Peyronie's disease, but really isn't used to treat Lederhosen's disease, which, remember, that is plantar fibromatosis, because rupture of the plantar fascia can create problems with walking and stability of the foot joints. So thoughtfulness about where you use the product, I think, is going to be important moving forward. But there are a lot of opportunities here, and I'm excited to see it come to market.
Why do they keep ending the name of this product with hyphen AAES?
I'm not sure if this is the same thing where we're starting to see with the biosimilars that you put the 4 letter random postfix. So, you know, a lot of the biosimilar biologics actually have the 4 letter postfix following them to signify their identity as a biosimilar product. I don't know if it's that. I actually wasn't able to determine that from the publication, but I did think it was interesting.
So these women received 3 injections each 3 weeks apart. So presumably once this reaches the market, that's going to be the protocol. And it sounds like it's not approved yet, or at least it's not out yet. So we don't know how much stuff is going to cost. And despite the negative effect of cellulite on the quality of life and self-esteem, I think most people would consider this a cosmetic treatment. And so one of the most important things when you're thinking about outcomes in cosmetic treatments are how satisfied the patients were. And the numbers really aren't very good. So more women treated with the medicine than with placebo were satisfied or very satisfied with their treatment, but it was like 50% versus 20%.
Yeah.
So that means if you are somebody who is doing this to women, half of them are not going to be satisfied. And that's kind of a tough pill to swallow, especially since I'm guessing most of the marketing materials aren't going to say stuff like that.
You know, I think that some of it might stem from the unrealistic results that are presented to people constantly when you're being sold this barrage of bizarre gadgets that people are shown ads for. And I actually think that this is a shifting expectation problem that we also face anywhere in aesthetics, where there's these, you know, facial creams that get advertised or something. And then other, you know, dermatologists or plastic surgeons have actually identified their before and afters having been stolen from their website and used to advertise like a skincare product. And then, you know, the person who's originated the photo said this person had a facelift, fat transfer, and photo rejuvenation. And this website's claiming that this cream did this. So patients' expectations of what we're able to do, I think, shifts based off of what they're presented with as a therapeutic option. So even though realistically they may have tried 15 of these sun cup body kneading devices or whatever and not had any results, in their mind they think, well, if this the counter product can get these great results, imagine what a plastic surgeon with a procedure in their office could do. So I think that some of that is as a measure of the unrealistic expectations of the patient population. I also think that some of it is a measure of the unrealistic expectations in the beauty industry created by things like Photoshop and idealization of this exquisitely rare female phenotype that doesn't have cellulite, right? So like the idea that, you know, a bottom with any dimples in it is not a worthwhile bottom, you know, is a very kind of artificial and really, you know, inaccessible ideal that I think that we have to try to help normalize our patients' expectations of. So when I subscribed to the House of Booty, I was given access to these nice before and after photos with the slider where you can slide it back and forth and look at the before and after over and over again, if that, you know, satisfies you. And there definitely is improvement, but, you know, all of the post-treatment results, even their best ones that they chose to highlight, these women still have some cellulite, and that is a realistic human body. And I think that making sure that you establish realistic expectations is important. I do actually think people are already doing this because there's a feature on the House of Booty kind of website where you can put your zip code and figure out if there's anybody in your area doing this. And there are two providers in my area already doing this. So I think that there are patients under treatment with this potential therapeutic injectable. And I'm hopeful that we can both help some of these women get closer to a body they feel comfortable with and hopefully also normalize in a normal, adult, healthy female body.
So Quo is on the market then. How much does it cost?
I don't know that part. I have not done the price shopping.
I just found it online. So some surgery center says it's anywhere from $1,800 to $3,200 per session.
Yeah, so I would expect that to have to do with how many injection sites needed to be treated, which seem to be identified by dimples and ridges on the kind of treatment protocol.
That's for the full three treatment sessions.
Okay. So, I mean, that's more accessible, yeah, you know, for people.
Not
it's
as horrible
expensive
as it could be.
It's expensive. It's for sure expensive.
Not to get sidetracked too much, but we did have a discussion about behavioral economics and dermatology an episode or two ago. So if people are paying $3,000 to get this procedure, do you think that will increase or decrease their satisfaction with the outcome?
That's a very good question, because I feel like patients want to pay enough for something where they feel like it's worthwhile and going to do something, but they also don't want it to cost more than a procedure that would be considered like the next level up. You know, so one might consider potentially liposuction to be the step you would follow after doing the injectable collagenase. And, you know, liposuction procedures are advertised by various providers starting, you know, around $5,000 to $6,000. So I think that making this a price point sort of halfway between that is a reasonable niche for that. I'm just interested in seeing how this product can be used in a lot of other applications. And I'm also, you know, glad that they have some treatment for this, because it really does create distress in some people. And it makes people kind of change their behavior and potentially not encounter life as fully as they should, which makes me sad. They did have the patients in this study refrain from things that could help camouflage the appearance of cellulite, which included both using artificial tanners as well as, you know, indoor tanning. I, of course, agree with not indoor tanning people. I think that, you know, if people are uncomfortable with the appearance of their, you know, cellulite or something, sometimes using camouflage products, body makeups, or like sunless tanners can be helpful.
I brought up the price thing because I think in psychology, like in the individual's brain, there's a tension between I paid for this, I'm a smart person, and I pay for stuff that works, so therefore it worked, versus I don't want to pay for stuff that doesn't work. I'm extra pissed off that I'm not happy with my cellulite response. Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, good discussion. Another society and dermatology interaction there. And as much as I am interested in female bottoms, I am also even more interested in pediatric atopic dermatitis.
Beautiful segue.
Yep, I guess that's what happens when you're a 41-year-old pediatric dermatologist. So this is another big randomized controlled trial. This was published in The Lancet. And it's called Once Daily Upadacitinib versus Placebo in Adolescents and Adults with Moderate to Severe Atopic Dermatitis, Measure Up 1 and Measure Up 2, results from two replicate double-blind randomized controlled phase 3 trials. These are giant multi-center international studies. The authors include Emma Gutman, Yaski, and Alan Irvine. Eric Simpson, old mentor of mine from OHSU days, also on the study here. So these are the trials that's going to get this medicine, upadacitinib, approved for atopic dermatitis in adolescents and adults. So the upshot, upadacitinib is a pill. It works for atopic dermatitis, and it has few side effects. So you're going to see it on the market pretty soon, I think. So upadacitinib, I might just start calling it UPA, like a polka, is a JAK inhibitor. So JAK, if you haven't heard of it, J-A-K. So many cell signaling pathways, including lots of interleukin, signal through this JAK-STAT pathway. JAK actually stands for Janus kinase. I think we talked about this many episodes ago, but Janus is this Roman god of like thresholds. Mm-hmm. So he's got two faces, one looking forward and one looking back. So if you see pictures of him, he's like basically got another face on the back of his head. So one looking in each direction out the door, basically. And the molecules are named after Janus because they also somehow have two active sites or something.
Yes, we reviewed in episode 31 an article about Janus kinase inhibitors working in morphia. So they were actually using them to prevent bleomycin-induced fibrosis in mice. It was a very sciencey article from the Journal of Investigative Dermatology.
All right. So they have lots of different applications. So interleukins are particularly important in atopic dermatitis. There are some in particular, like interleukin-4, interleukin-13. Those you probably remember, ding, ding, are the interleukins that are blocked by dupilumab, which is currently the only systemic medication out there on the market approved for atopic dermatitis. IL-31, considered to be the itch cytokine, is also important in atopic dermatitis and also signals through the JAK-STAT pathway. So there's a number of different JAK receptors, and four of them are of particular pharmaceutical importance. There's JAK1, JAK2, and JAK3, and then there's one called TYK, or TYK. So UPA has greater affinity for JAK1 than for the others, which is thought to be good for the atopic dermatitis relevant cytokines, and it's already approved for rheumatoid arthritis in this country. By the way, there's another JAK inhibitor, abrocitinib, that is selective for JAK1, that's also in trials for atopic dermatitis and is looking good. So this study here out of The Lancet reports two big multi-center international randomized placebo-controlled phase 3 trials. They were called Measure Up 1 and Measure Up 2. So actually not that dissimilar from the trial you just described with the collagenases. There were actually a similar number of patients too, about 850. They were aged 12 and up, so adolescents were involved. They all had moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, and they were assigned to one of three arms, upadacitinib 15 milligrams daily, or 30 milligrams daily, or to placebo. They could not use topicals while they were on these medications. And UPA was way better across all metrics. The 30 milligrams was a bit better than the 15 milligrams, though they point out in the article, and I'm not sure why, that no statistical analyses were performed to compare the two groups specifically, the 15 versus 30 milligram groups. So we're not sure if the extra improvement from 30 milligrams was statistically significant. I don't know why they didn't run those numbers, but there you go. Upadacitinib seemed to start working as early as the first week, and some patients noted improvement in their itch within days. The medication seemed to reach max effect between week 4 and week 8, and the trials continued up to week 16, where they stopped this particular trial, but there is an ongoing extension, which will get published later on. So people got better on upadacitinib, but they mostly didn't clear completely. So some of the metrics they used, and they used quite a few of them. So the EASI score, EASI, I think we've mentioned that on the podcast before, is a measure of eczema severity, and it's something that you can kind of grade in clinic. But despite the name, it is not easy to calculate, so it's used mostly in trials. So EASI 75 is kind of like PASI 75 in psoriasis. So EASI 75 means you got 75% or more improvement in your EASI score, okay? So you can basically think that that's somebody getting 75% better in terms of their eczema. So at week 16, 70% of patients in the upadacitinib 15 milligram arm achieved an EASI 75, 80% in the 30 milligram group, and only 16% in placebo. And then all the other metrics, things like quality of life and itch and depression, anxiety scores all were very similar. They also looked at EASI 90, so basically 90% improvement in your EASI score, 90% improvement in your eczema, perhaps. about 50% of people in the UPA groups, and EZ 100, basically clearing, remember they couldn't use topicals, so clear just on drug was about 20%. So, wow. You know, not very many still, but one in five people, it's not too shabby. The adverse effects were mild. There were no new safety risks compared with its use in rheumatoid arthritis, though there were a few new emergent side effects that didn't show up so much in the RA trial. So acne was one of them. So 7% in the 50 milligram group, 17% in the 30 milligram group, and only 2% in the placebo group got acne. URIs, upper respiratory tract infections, 9% and 13% in the UPA groups, 7% in placebo. Nasopharyngitis, the numbers were 8 and 12% in the UPA groups and 6% in placebo. Elevation in creatine phosphokinase, 6% in both upadacitinib groups and 3% in the placebo group. What's going on there? Well, they were asymptomatic and they were associated with exercise. They did say there was a single case of rhabdomyolysis that was reported in a 23-year-old man in the 15-milligram group. He had elevated CPK, no change in his renal function. Perhaps there was this inciting factor of jet skiing within the good life. He had muscle pain and cramping of all four limbs. He was tired. He had fatigue. All of his symptoms resolved within 4 days, but they stopped the upadacitinib there. So, you know, that's the story with that particular guy. Lymphopenia. So they were measuring people's labs. A few people got lymphopenia, neutropenia, but it seemed to be transient and just get better. Remember, this was done over the past year or so. During the COVID pandemic, they did report that there were things that they did to keep everybody safe and comply with guidelines, like courier drugs to people and do telehealth appointment for follow-up and things. And nobody got COVID. That's Woo-hoo! Nice. Possible limitation, patients were mostly white, 66%, or Asian, 23%. So maybe that limits this drug's ability to impact other groups. Other tidbits. So, you know, there it is. It works. It's pretty safe. I was not sure that I knew all of this, that adults with atopic dermatitis have an increased risk of some other stuff like GI issues, inflammatory bowel disease, alopecia areata, vitiligo, chronic spontaneous urticaria, and also rheumatoid arthritis. And many of the approximately 30 known atopic dermatitis associated genetic loci are implicated in other autoimmune diseases. Well, they say other immune-mediated diseases, I'm sorry, not necessarily autoimmune. Not sure I knew all of that stuff. So this is coming, and, you know, only 20% of people with EZ 100 is, you know, a significant minority. So I was like, is this medicine really that good? It's going to get compared to dupilumab a lot, of course. So I looked into the comparisons a bit. So first of all, upadacitinib's a pill and dupilumab's a shot. Upadacitinib, something you would have to take once or twice a day. Dupilumab, something you just take every 2 weeks or maybe even every 4 weeks if you're a kid. So everybody's going to have their own opinion about that, but I assume most people are going to want to take a pill instead of get a shot. And the dupilumab trials, EZ75 at week 16 was achieved by about 50% of patients. So in that sense, upadacitinib does look a bit better because the numbers are higher. Remember, we had 70 and 80% of people get to that point. Though, you know, it's tough to compare them directly. Populations aren't necessarily similar, blah, blah, blah. Monitoring is also something to think about. So basically, you don't need to do any monitoring in dupilumab. It's a very safe medication. According to the website UpToDate, monitoring guidelines for upadacitinib are to get a CBC and LFTs at baseline and, quote, periodically, whatever that means, lipid levels at 12 weeks, and then again, periodically. And they recommend that you screen for hepatitis and tuberculosis before starting. There was no recommendations for screening creatine phosphokinase, even though apparently it can be elevated. So I don't know what you're supposed to do about that. Since this is already approved for rheumatoid arthritis, you can just go buy this medicine if you want to try to get it for your atopic dermatitis patients that's out there. The brand name, at least for its RA indication, is Rinvoq, R-I-N-V-O-Q. And you can buy 30 15 milligram tablets for $5,500, according to GoodRx. A shot of dupilumab is probably about $3,500. Most adults would need two per month, so you're looking at $7,000 for that. So maybe upadacitinib is a little bit cheaper on top of it all. This is good. I mean, I am nervous because so many pathways in the body use this JAK-STAT pathway, so I kept expecting some horrible side effect to emerge as people kept using these medicines, but so far nothing has emerged. It would be awesome if it worked well and were safe. I mean, obviously, that would be awesome. I have a lot of kids with atopic dermatitis. They don't like shots. They're okay taking pills. I think that this would be especially nice to have available for them. So it's pretty exciting that we're moving into a world where we have more, not zero and not one, but more than one good options for people with really bad atopic dermatitis.
I think it's really nice also just to have something to offer those rare patients or who are dupilumab, either response losers who have lost the response to dupilumab that you can't rescue back, or patients who don't respond completely. But yeah, the Janus kinase inhibitors are opening up a whole new sort of walnut shell of different kinds of therapeutic options. And we just need to, of course, pay attention to whether or not we're messing with their important functions in the body. But it's exciting to have some new products come to the market for these challenging diseases, for sure.
I was dreaming about upadacitinib last night, Michelle. Maybe that's just because I was going over this article right before bed, but I don't think I've been dreaming about a medicine lately.
That's pretty exciting. So, talking about something that's hard to treat and affects a lot of people, would it be 2021 if we didn't talk about something having to do with COVID? So this is an article we've been trying to review several weeks in a row and we keep having to kind of put off because that's some great basic science that I think we should be familiar with as dermatologists, given that we use medications that impact the axis we're going to discuss. This is a case series that is out of JAD Case Reports, entitled Oral Angiotensin Converting Enzyme Inhibitors for the Treatment of Delayed Inflammatory Reaction to Dermal Hyaluronic Acid Fillers Following COVID-19 Vaccination, a Model for Inhibition of Angiotensin II-Induced Cutaneous Inflammation. The authors are Girish Gili Munavalli, Siri Knutson Larson, Mary Lupo, who's awesome, and Roy G. Geronimus, MD, and they're out of Charlotte and Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Williams, South Dakota, New Orleans, Louisiana, and New York, New York. In this case series, they four patients that had delayed inflammatory reaction to initial dermal hyaluronic acid filler, which occurred rapidly following vaccination for COVID-19 with either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccination. They did not have any patients reported in this case series that had facial filler reaction following Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca. All of the delayed inflammatory reactions occurred after the hyaluronic acid filler had been present for more than 1 year, and all patients responded very quickly to a low dose of oral lisinopril, which is an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, and that helped to decrease the cutaneous filler-related inflammatory reaction and edema by a novel proposed mechanism. And that's pretty fascinating, so I'm going to spend most of the time reviewing this article going over that. I'm not going to go into the details of every single patient, but I will say that they had a good split between the different patients. So they had some of the patients had Pfizer, some of the patients had Moderna. Two of the patients had their delayed inflammatory response after their first dose of vaccine and two after the second dose only. They had no history of angioedema in any of the patients. One of the patients had a history of a filler reaction with an upper respiratory infection. One of the patients had a history of an idiopathic urticaria in the past. And the patient that had the history of the filler reaction had been previously successfully treated with hyaluronidase. All of the patients developed the delayed inflammatory response within 24 to 48 hours after the vaccine, and they all improved after treatment with oral lisinopril within about 3 to 5 days. So they proposed that this could be a mechanism for treating delayed inflammatory response. They also proposed it could be a mechanism to try to prophylax against recurrence of that response with subsequent second dose vaccination and potentially booster vaccines. So I thought that was all very sound. So very quickly, I'm going to take you back to medical school so that we can understand the system we're talking about. And I think as dermatologists, especially those of us who prescribe medications that run into the aldosterone part of this system, we should understand how it works. So in our bodies, one of the very most important things our bodies have to do to maintain homeostasis is maintain cardiac output, normal blood volume, and blood pressure. So when any of those variables change, our body reacts and tries to correct that. So if we have anything that decreases renal blood flow, then we have cells that are in the juxtaglomerular part of the afferent arterial, so the part that's taking blood into the kidneys. If these cells, which are baroreceptors, sense that there's a drop in blood pressure, they'll release renin. These are also sometimes called renin-releasing granular cells. So these release renin into circulation. renin can be released by that mechanism. It can also be released because in the efferent arteriole, you have cells that can actually measure how much sodium is present. The slower our body is filtering the blood through the glomeruli, the longer our body has to absorb sodium. Sodium drops too low in that efferent arteriole. There are cells that can also kind of go tickle those juxtaglomerular cells and tell them, hey, we've got really low sodium concentrations here. We've got to deal with this blood flow problem. And again, renin gets released by that. Another way that you get renin release is through the sympathetic nervous system. So when we have our fight or flight response, you have increased renin release to help us get enough blood pressure and cardiac output to run away from the tiger or whatever's causing that. That's why there's sort of those tropes and, you know, different sitcoms where they're like, oh, don't get so upset, honey, your blood pressure. When people have that activation of that sympathetic nervous system, they can have an increase in blood pressure because of direct release, stimulation of release of renin by the sympathetic nervous system. So renin
to give a quick shout out to the nephrologist who taught us this stuff in medical school, Dr. Jamie Johnston. He's awesome. I'm thinking of you. Hope you're doing well.
Woohoo! So renin gets released into circulation. In circulation, we also have our happy little liver, our good friend, of course, hopefully for our whole lifetime, who has released something called angiotensinogen. That tensinogen-like ending tells you that this is a zymogen. A zymogen is an inactive precursor of an enzyme. Something else has to act on it and it becomes activated. So angiotensinogen produced by the liver is also in circulation. When renin hits angiotensinogen, it turns it into angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 is now circulating. And then when that comes by the pulmonary circulation, we have angiotensin-converting enzymes. So you remember that that is in the lungs. So angiotensin-converting enzyme converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2's job is to vasoconstrict. So it constricts arterioles, it increases blood pressure. It also, because it's constricting blood flow, it's kind of going to increase the filtration rate. That's going to increase the sodium in the distal collecting tubules. So that actually helps also get more water into circulation and increases blood volume. And then also, angiotensin 2 travels all the way back to the adrenal cortex and stimulates the release of aldosterone. Aldosterone increases sodium retention, you get more water retention, you increase blood pressure and blood volume. So all of that kind of works through our body to maintain our blood flow, our blood pressure, and our cardiac output. Angiotensin 2 also tells the posterior pituitary gland to release antidiuretic hormone, which decreases how much water we let go of in our body. So we increase water retention. All of that increases blood volume. So that's how that pathway works.
Isn't now, the human body amazing?
It's really kind of fascinating. To be completely honest, it's really kind of amazing. So now we are asking ourselves probably, how the heck does this have any role with facial filler granulomas or facial
filler reactions? Why should a dermatologist care about all that stuff?
So now we need to understand what happens when we're vaccinated with the mRNA vaccine specifically for COVID, and also what could happen with COVID. So we understand how the whole angiotensin, renin, aldosterone system is working. So when we get vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines, we have mRNA come into our body that's taken up, and cells then produce this spike protein. The spike protein is able to stimulate the production of antibodies, which is good. That's what we want to have happen. The spike protein also is made to bind onto the ACE2, so the angiotensin-converting enzyme receptor. So that is a very important interaction, and it's even more important because it's an irreversible binding. So that's the target ligand for the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein is ACE2. Membrane-bound and soluble ACE2 have a job to do when they're not being bound and occupied by the spike protein, either produced by our vaccinated bodies or produced by the virus. So when ACE2 is not busily stuck to spike protein, its actual job is to convert angiotensin 2 into the metabolites angiotensin 1 through 7. And that's important because angiotensin 2 is a pro-inflammatory mediator. So we end up having increased inflammatory cytokines and other effects that can worsen the swelling of filler present in the body. So I just want you to think about the fact that COVID spike is irreversibly binding that membrane-bound ACE2, preventing it from doing its job of taking angiotensin 2 away from the circulation and converting it into the anti-inflammatory metabolites, angiotensin 1 through 7. So we basically have downregulation of ACE2, which means you can't locally control angiotensin 2, which is a problem when you're treating with filler granulomas for a reason I'm about to explain. Of course, other tissues, this is important as well. Cardiac, renal, and vascular tissue also have that ACE2 receptor, which is why some of those organ systems fail when patients are severely ill with COVID-19. We need a functional renin angiotensin system in all of our body. We also need it in our skin, and it is mirrored in our skin just like it is in the body. It actually has a role in maintaining keratinocyte differentiation, mediating wound healing, and sodium balance. So if we accumulate angiotensin II, we actually get upregulation of the expression of monocyte chemoattractant protein type 1, tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6, and interleukin 8. All of these are chemoattractants and activators of neutrophils. Additionally, intracellular binding of angiotensin II to the angiotensin 1 receptor, which is the angiotensin 2 receptor type 1, has vasoconstrictive properties as well as proliferative, prothrombotic, and profibrotic responses. Finally, and I think most importantly in this scenario, angiotensin II actually upregulates something called CD44, which is a glycoprotein that's expressed on the surface of mammalian cells, including lymphocytes, endothelial cells, macrophages, fibroblasts, and keratinocytes. CD44 glycoprotein has affinity to bind free extracellular hyaluronic acid, especially low molecular weight hyaluronic acid. So this can be a nidus for the inflammatory reaction targeting the quiescent hyaluronic acid granuloma. So basically, the angiotensin II levels are high. Our body's got occupied ACE2, so it can't metabolize that angiotensin II into angiotensin 1 or 1 through 7. So it can't kind of disarm angiotensin. So angiotensin II is increasing the number of pro-inflammatory cytokines in the milieu, and it's also increasing the expression of the CD44 glycoprotein, which is basically allowing all of these resident cells in the skin, lymphocytes, endothelial cells, macrophages, fibroblasts, it's enabling them to get more angry, basically, at low molecular weight hyaluronic acid. So they presume that we actually have this sort of little stalemate of a quiescent filler kind of granuloma, where it's just quiet, and it's slowly decaying and breaking up into these low molecular weight hyaluronic acid fragments, and that you have T cells in the neighborhood, but everyone's just kind of standing there. No one's, you know, there's no shots fired. Nobody's doing anything exciting. It's slowly breaking down through its normal catabolism, and you may have something that triggers then the development of a granuloma or reaction product. So when we have this subclinical quiescent granuloma sitting there with our CD8 and CD4 positive T cells and macrophages and fibroblasts, we've got dermal microcirculation involved because of angiogenesis. If we have then a tipping of the balance by the blockade of ACE2 and the inability for ACE2 to then metabolize angiotensin 2 into angiotensin 1, 7, you accidentally sort of activate this inflammatory process. You change the kind of milieu of the perigranuloma tissue, and you may increase the inflammation in the area. So the ACE inhibitor actually helps by blocking the production systemically of angiotensin II. So you're reducing the substrate for ACE2, which is blocked by binding the spike protein. Basically, you're compensating for the fact that you have functional downregulation of ACE2 secondary to irreversible binding to the spike protein. And so you can shift towards the anti-inflammatory response by blocking angiotensin II through the ACE inhibitor. And that way you can actually help to improve the fact that you have this localized swelling as well as localized immune stimulation by this angiotensin II that's getting stuck in the tissue since we can't get rid of angiotensin II through ACE2's metabolism, which should be happening since it's stuck to the COVID spike protein. So that, I think, is a nice explanation of how it can help. Lisinopril is well tolerated. It has minimal side effects. Again, they said that we could potentially even use this prophylactically before vaccination, even in patients who haven't had an episode of delayed inflammatory reaction to the filler, just to minimize that risk. I have some patients that have a lot of filler who were actually apprehensive about taking the vaccine for this reason. And I think that this could potentially help allay some of those concerns. A lot of patients take antihypertensive drugs. 35% of prescriptions for antihypertensives in the U.S. are ACE inhibitors. It's broadly used medication. It has a wide safety profile, a relatively quick half-life, about 6 hours, and it gets filtered out of the blood relatively easily. 5 milligrams is a good starting point. 10 milligrams can be a point we titrate up to for patients who need that. We do need to remember that you have cautious about using other drugs that can also cause hyperkalemia. So you wouldn't want to use Cipro or Bactrim, which are antibiotics that can act as potassium sparing diuretics. And of course, you wouldn't want to also use spironolactone with the ACE inhibitors. So you might short-term discontinue any of those drugs if you were using the ACE inhibitors to treat or profile against the delayed inflammatory response. We also have to remember it can cause cough because ACE inhibitors increase bradykinin levels by inhibiting their degradation. So cough may be a side effect, but that usually takes a while for that to occur. And so patients that you're treating for this short period of time, usually less than a week, probably aren't going to have that problem. Angioedema is a real concern that is more likely to have an occurrence in patients who are of African descent. They have a 5 times greater risk of ACE inhibitor-induced angioedema. So that would be something also to consider. You might want to use a even, you know, quicker acting, shorter half-life medication like captopril in patients who might have an increased risk of angioedema. But it's a very good and safe way to help treat patients who have a delayed inflammatory reaction with filler related to COVID-19 vaccination or with COVID-19 illness, which was also reported.
So that was pretty complex. The authors obviously thought a lot about this pathway. Can I just try to simplify it? So angiotensin is thought to be what produces this swelling response in people who have filler.
Angiotensin 2, yes.
Angiotensin 2. The spike protein binds to angiotensin 2's receptor, so it can't bind to its receptor, so there's more of it.
Yeah, so it binds
to... That's why it creates the swelling. Mm-hmm. But lisinopril decreases the production of angiotensin 2, so that's how you can compensate for this issue.
Exactly.
But we still don't know why some people with filler get this swelling reaction and others don't.
We don't really 100% understand it. However, there was a study that was done by Decate et al., where they looked at patients who'd had a delayed inflammatory response to filler versus patients who hadn't, and they found that certain HLA types were overrepresented. So patients who had HLA-B*08 or D1B*03, those patients had a greater risk of having a delayed inflammatory response. So it may have to do with genetics, and it may have a kind of HLA-mediated interaction there. So we don't know why some people are going to get filler reactions and some people aren't. Biofilms have been suggested as potentially priming the pump for this problem. ACE inhibitors have been looked at also to treat other cutaneous disease, including hypertrophic scars, keloid, systemic sclerosis, and recessive dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa. So the fact that the renin-angiotensin system is functional and active in the skin has a lot of implications. But I think it's actually very elegant how they explained this. It makes sense. The permanent binding of the spike protein to the ACE2, which is the receptor for angiotensin 2, which then can convert it into its inactive and less inflammatory metabolites, I think is an important step in understanding why this can occur.
And this business of filler that's just been sitting in somebody's face doing nothing for a long time, suddenly getting swollen in response to a vaccine or a viral infection has been reported with other viral infections as well. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be I guess the COVID virus and the COVID vaccine seem to cause it more frequently, though it's still pretty rare.
Mm-hmm. The authors actually postulated this may become one of the leading causes of delayed inflammatory reaction to filler. I don't know that that's completely borne out yet, but it is definitely something to be aware of.
If you are interested in a discussion of dermatologic reactions to COVID vaccines that are much less specific, see episode 53. Well, that is all the time we have today, guys. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. So today we learned about dermatology memes. Does art mimic life or influence it? Or perhaps both. We learned about collagenase is modestly effective for buttock cellulite. We learned that upadacitinib works pretty well for atopic dermatitis and is probably going to be approved in short order, I would guess. And we learned that you can use lisinopril to correct COVID vaccine-induced swelling of filler. Thanks to our institutions, thanks to the University of Utah for supporting this podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. And thanks to you for listening. If you would like to listen to more, you can find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which is also a good way to get in touch with us. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thanks also to Ryan Carlisle, medical student and member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps those moving along. Thanks to you again for chilling out with us today and learning about some dermatology. And we will see you in 2 weeks.